But if we can optimize epigenetics by age 19, we set the system in a really good place for the rest of our life. But also, if we can optimize epigenetics before we conceive the next generation, we're actually passing cleaner genes onto the next 6 to 8 generations, which is awful powerful when you talk about helping the person themselves, the child, the adult. But also, if you can do it during maybe an optimal time frame of their life, you got generations following you that are benefiting from the choices that you make. And rather than all these childhood diseases that we see now that are so darn common, it's, oh my gosh, children, if it's not autism, it's developmental delay. If it's not that, it's ADD, ADHD. If it's not that, it's depression, anxiety. If it's not that, it's bipolar, schizophrenia. If it's not that, it's migraines or seizures.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. This week's episode, I sit down with Dr. David Billstrom, a quadruple board certified physician specializing in autoimmune and chronic diseases, to explore a deeper integrative approach to health. Dr. Billstrom shares how modern medicine often focuses on managing symptoms rather than addressing root causes, and how factors like stress, gut health, inflammation, and epigenetics play a critical role in long-term well-being. Our conversation explores the body as an interconnected system, highlighting the importance of prevention, lifestyle, and understanding the underlying mechanisms of disease. From the microbiome to sunlight exposure, and from generational health to immune function, this episode provides a comprehensive look at how we can take greater ownership of our health. Dr. David Billstrom is an author, international speaker, and specialist in autoimmune and chronic diseases. He holds quadruple board certification in functional and regenerative medicine, integrative medicine, physical medicine, and rehabilitation, and medical acupuncture. Please check out all the ways you can find Dr. Billstrom's work online. And as always, the content shared on this podcast is for educational, informational purposes only and should not be considered therapy. If you're seeking therapy, please reach out to a certified professional. Now, let's just jump right into the episode. Dr. Billstrom, welcome to Easy Conversations. How are you doing? I could tell based on the background, like pretty good.
I'm doing pretty good. This is actually my clinical office right here. I do clinic outside. Everything's virtual. And this is my office. I actually have a tan on my feet from my flip-flops while doing clinical work. Not many doctors can say that.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty envious right now just hearing that. Looks great, but getting some sun, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that today too. But before we get into the things we're going to talk about specifically around autoimmune diseases and all of that, but just want to get a bit of an understanding of who you are and what it is that you do, just for the audience to ground them.
You mean just having a tan on my feet from flip-flops from doing clinic doesn't tell you everything already?
No.
I'm happy to share other stuff though if you want.
Please do.
Okay. I grew up playing tennis, played tennis in college, scholarship D1 athlete, and loved art, loved literature. And that was my passion. But then I also loved science. And about halfway through, I gave up tennis and moved to pre-med, and I just love the science, and went through all my training, University of Illinois Medical School, University of Colorado, my residency, and my residency was in physical medicine and rehabilitation. So we tend to be the folks that people get sent to when nobody else, you know, knows what to do with them, or they have a lot of catastrophic stuff like strokes, spinal cord injuries, all this other traumatic brain injuries, all these kind of things. And so my subspecialty was spinal cord injury rehabilitation. So everybody I saw when I first got out of training in Charlotte, North Carolina, this huge rehab hospital, 200 different beds, all different specialties, everybody I saw was paralyzed from the neck down and the waist down. And they tend to be a very challenging population of people because those kind of neurologic injuries impact everything, everything. Not just the neurologic system, but the musculoskeletal, the hormones, the gut, the bladder, the bowels, the you name it. And they also tend to be really sensitive to medication side effects. So something that you and I, as a non-spinal cord injured person, might not even think twice about for taking, let's say, like a stuffy nose, could kill these people. And So you'd be using a medicine for a specific thing, but then the side effects would start kicking in. Maybe just when we started getting some benefit and we go, oh crap, we can't use that. We got to go to the next med, including for some of these kind of like neurologic stuff, we'd actually would use medicines for their side effects.
Mm.
Medicines that nobody else ever uses anymore because the side effects are so profound. But we can use those profound side effects, such as somebody with a spinal cord injury who has a real trouble with like bowel continence.
Mm.
And they're trying to get out of the community, be an active part of the community again, and they can't control their bowels, which is really counterproductive. So there may be a medicine like a cardiac medicine that nobody uses anymore because it makes people so darn constipated and you're trying to fix them with this heart thing that nobody would use it. We would use it for the constipation part, right? So they could stay continent, go on the community and not poop on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But then it would alter their heart rhythm just as we're getting where we wanted to get and we couldn't use it anymore. And I kept wondering over time, you know, is there something else that we could offer these folks and, that I don't know about currently? And wouldn't it be great if there was no side effects? It's a tall order with medications. Mm-hmm. So as I was looking into this, more and more acupuncture started coming up. It's great for bowel, great for bladder, great for pain, great for nerve issues, great for musculoskeletal, like overuse injuries when they're trying to push a wheelchair all over the place, you know, all these different kind of things. And there was nobody that really did it, or I was at the time, we're talking about 30 years ago now. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go to UCLA and I'm going to train in medical acupuncture for physicians. And I'm going to bring it back and see if it can help any of these folks as one last ditch effort to help when nothing else would help. When I got back, I had 11 different rehab partners and they were in the same position I was. And so when they go, oh gosh, we got another option here and without any side effects, this is so cool. So I was just like looking for a simple tennis elbow when I first started. And instead I got like the worst of the worst, the most complicated of the most complicated people that all my partners and I had seen. Oh my gosh, it worked so great. And I'm like, holy cow, these people that are so complicated get so much better. And pretty quickly, I started doing just a ton of acupuncture, like 100 treatments a week, because we had so many people that needed this. But also got me thinking, and actually on this 30-year journey, that what else is out there that I never learned about in my traditional training that could help people? I was thinking this population, but it turns out, well, this reverses all chronic disease. And it turns out that there are so many things out there that I didn't learn in my traditional training.
Right.
But again, we've had this absolute explosion in medical knowledge like the last 50 years. And I used to lecture like 35, 40 years ago, 30, 25 years ago. And I'd say medical knowledge started doubling in 1865. And then 1945, it was like seven times more every year. And then I'd say by 2020, it's going to be doubling every 73 days. Here we are past 2020 and it's doubling faster than every 73 days. There's so much out there. But it's hard for people to keep up.
Right.
You're just trying to keep up with the stuff that you know, but want to fine tune things for most medical doctors. So there's so much out there though, science that people just don't know about, except if you like do these deep dives into these funky things that geeky sciencey things that I like to do deep dives in that are very specific for why people get chronic disease and how to reverse chronic disease. Not so much just put a new medicine on something that puts a bandage on a symptom, but has all these side effects and doesn't fix why you got in the first place. And that why he's pushing you to new things. That's people get on two meds, three meds, five meds, eight meds, 10 meds, 12 meds, because they never got rid of the reason they got the first chronic health issue. And that just keeps pushing the new ones.
Yes.
As time goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I'm hearing from you also is not trying to approach medicine in isolation or in a silo, really the integration of perhaps one can call it Eastern medicine with Western medicine, which is something that's becoming more and more common. To your point, I've spoken to other physicians who decided to go get trained in acupuncture and bring that into their practice as well. So from your perspective, why do you think that's happening now? Is it just because we can see the other side of the information that perhaps we were not necessarily exposed to in the past, and it's harder to now work in isolation when you have all this other information available, even though it may seem unorthodox from a Western medicine perspective?
I think one of the things is there is so much science, and I always want people to know, and I go out of my way, that whatever I say, it's not someone's opinion. This is the science. And so I have over 150 different YouTube videos, and you're probably going to see me do something like, and this article from the Journal of This,
yes,
19, what says this, right? Mm. So I want people to know this is a science, and the science is very clear why people get chronic health issues, and the science is very clear how we can reverse them. But also, I think industries are driven by demand, by the people that they serve. And so no industry is going to change unless they're forced to change by the people they take care of. And so what I think people are saying in the last 20, 30 years, this generation, another generation, was, I've seen my parents and grandparents on 15, 20 meds, and they are not feeling well. Their quality of life is not good. So I can see that just putting medicines, bandages on these bullet holes, might keep them going, but they're not having the life they want. They're feeling miserable. Plus, they got all these side effects from the meds, and the meds are having adverse reactions with each other, creating a new problem, they need a new med. And they're like, that's not where I want to go. And they're demanding a change here. They demand something better. To your point, you know, what people have been taught, fortunately, they're unlearning this, but doctors have been taught this, is like everything is looked at in a silo. Oh, you have a lung issue, see the lung doctor. Heart issue, heart doctor. Stomach issue, stomach doctor. Skin issue, skin doctor. That skin doctor may know skin pretty good, but doesn't know how everything else works, including doesn't know there's a really tight gut-skin connection. That brain doctor might know brain stuff, but he doesn't know there's a big gut-brain connection. The stomach and bowel doctor knows stomach and bowel, but he doesn't know how it impacts the skin, the eyes, the brain, the immune system, all this. So you really got to get rid of all these different silos, because everything in our body is so darn connected. Everything's connected.
Yes. So
no matter what body part, what organ system is involved, it's tied in with everything else going on. And it's tied in with these big central mechanisms that control everything at the same time. So people that get really complicated, all these different organ systems impact at the same time. I don't sleep great. I'm tired. My joints are achy. My muscles feel weak. I got this brain fog. I get headaches. I got this rash. I got this bump, bloating, gassiness, constipation. To a more Western allopathic medical person, traditionally trained, they're going like, geez, I'm really confused. How can everything be off at the same time? I don't have a great answer for that. But for somebody like myself, like a functional medicine doc, it's, this is easy. The only way that everything can be off at the same time is these really important central mechanisms that drive all health or ill health are off. We can identify that with testing. We have the test to do this. It's not complicated, really. And we can identify exactly what's going on in this person and then put a person in position to everything get better at the same time. All the things get better at the same time. And then if they're on meds that they may not want to be on because of the side effects or this increases dementia risk, that's not great. People are getting dementia and Alzheimer's in their 50s and all this other kind of stuff. They're in a position to slowly wean down and off these meds, avoiding the downside, because now their body's taken over, does the work itself, just like it was designed to do. And they really have a high quality of life, and ultimately not just long life, longevity, but long, healthy life, a life that you can lead for long, long periods of time, feeling really good, not just feeling terrible and hanging in there till you get old.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things, there's a lot of research going on, but one of the things I've seen, at least in commonality, is biggest marker, perhaps even leading indicator, if you want to look at it, when it comes to longevity, stress is a huge factor. And you and I chatted about stress. And even early onset, right? With pregnancy, with the HPA axis, the development, stress, even in that state can affect the baby. And then now you go into living as an adult or even a child. We've talked about epigenetics and then the impact of stress on the microbiome. So stress from all angles throughout life, and then the impact that can have on one's health, autoimmune diseases or chronic illnesses as you're touching on them. Why is stress such a big factor when it comes to our health?
Yeah, and this is one aspect of what they talk about as generational health. where things get passed down from generation to generation. And there's a couple of different ways. You touched on microbiomes, you touched on epigenetics, but also this HPA axis. Mm-hmm. So maybe for those folks that are not so familiar, that's the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain, the pituitary gland, and then the adrenal gland that sits on top of the kidney that makes the stress hormone cortisol. And I think a lot of people are understanding that cortisol, the stress hormone, gets disrupted and it contributes to chronic disease. The bigger picture is this HPA axis. And the HPA axis is really how our body deals with stress. And it's tied into everything. Cardiovascular health, hormones, the gut, you name it, brain function is tied into it.
The one thing I didn't appreciate, the role the HPA axis plays in memory consolidation as well. So you could see then again, the impact of stress on our ability to retain information in our memory.
Yeah. If you're really stressed out before a test, it's going to be hard to remember stuff, right? You're relaxed out. You're going, I can remember stuff a lot better for this test I got tomorrow. It's an example kind of a thing. And so it's really tied into everything, including inflammation control. And so what I think I shared with you was like, I made a reference, a slide I used in a lecture in Paris back in the summer of 2024. When I talked about the four maternal microbiomes during pregnancy that determine the microbiome development of the developing fetus before they're even born, and how important it is to have the microbiomes in place to develop healthy fetal microbiomes, how it gets whacked, the negative impact of that, how to fix it, because everything can be fixed. So do this. And so it was a great slide from one of the articles where it has a mom pregnant and this big, nice picture of HPA axis. And it's directly tied into the fetus curled up. They're developing HPA axis. And so if the HPA axis has gotten disrupted by excessive stress, traumas, other kind of things, that's going to negatively impact the development of the fetal HPA axis and how they develop a healthy ability to deal with stress. That's sending them in such a compromised position, because if you can't optimally manage stress with a healthy HPA axis, here's all these things we just referenced that you don't want, and you're heading that direction right from the get-go. Now, of course, moms that are super stressed out during pregnancy, super stressed out chronically before they conceive a child, nobody can be blamed for this stuff because nobody knew this stuff. But this is where I'm trying to spread the word that this is very important stuff to ideally take care of before conceiving a child, ideally optimize that HPA axis development during pregnancy. And it's not as difficult as it might seem. It's like, how are you going to help a mom who was pregnant not be stressed out? I know it seems challenging, right? Because you're stressed out about all the changes in your body, what my life's going to be like, and all the other kind of stuff, all this emotional stress. But we can actually use simple tools to help optimally develop that HPA axis, even if the mom is quite stressed during the pregnancy for whatever reason. And it's not as difficult as it seems, but boy, is that important to set up that HPA axis. Or if it's disrupted, the development's disrupted, how can we reset the sucker early in life, ideally by age 19? If you can set the system by age 19, you really set somebody up for great health their whole life. Now, it's much easier to do that the first year of life, first couple years of life, because boy, our kids good at healing the younger they are, right? It's like you don't have to do hardly anything at those young ages, and boy, the body just rolls with it.
Yeah. And then perhaps along those lines of the first couple of years of life, the role of epigenetics, right? So it's not all doom and gloom. Obviously, you want to start off with a good foundation, but if for whatever reason you haven't been able to, your environment and epigenetics can play a huge factor. And I think sometimes people don't appreciate the role of turning on certain markers and that. So the DNA coding, it can be changed. We're not a victim of our genetic makeup.
So anything that drives chronic disease will tend to turn off good genes and turn off bad genes in our cells. And it's the genes that tell the cells what to do. And so this is where I used to think our genes were hardwired. And I think a lot of people still look at it this way, where whatever genes you got, good, bad, otherwise, you're stuck with them. And if you look at parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and they've had health problems, diseases that you go, geez, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. I don't want that. I hope I got their good genes, not their bad genes. It turns out, everybody's got a ton of bad genes. Everybody's got a ton of good genes. The question is, have you kept turned on the good ones, turned off the bad ones? And so when people are starting to not feel well, they're turning on the bad, turning off the good. That's another reason why it's so easy to get one problem and the second and the third and the fourth, because they're flipping genes the wrong way in all these different cells. Eventually, all these different cells cell types, organ systems are going to start suffering because of this. Now, but to your point, it's totally changeable. And actually the body will make things that work through epigenetics naturally. And there's things we can do to optimize that. Young ages is great. You hear me talk a lot about using vitamin D every day, at least the first year of life, if not longer. You got about 8 years to develop a healthy immune system once you're born. You got 8 years to screw it up. So that is compromised for your whole life. Has become, but something like vitamin D, the first year of life, they did this great study out of Northern Finland where they gave every child, half the children born in Northern Finland in 1966, 2000 IU of vitamin D every day, first year of life. That's a very small amount. Nobody's going to be optimally therapeutic on a blood test. You want to be like 70 to 90, maybe even 90 to 100. Nobody's going to be basically super therapeutic, but it's something. And it's something at a young age. And a little bit, these young age go a long way. They followed them for 36 years. I'm sorry, 31 years. And they saw that they got about an 80% reduction in type 1 diabetes. About 8 out of 10 cases were prevented. In our United States alone, we have over 300,000 young people under the age of 20 with type 1 diabetes now. There's such an epidemic of type 1 diabetes. It used to be called childhood onset diabetes until adults started getting it. And I think the powers that should that be should have gone, holy cow, how come adults are getting a child's disease? That's crazy. We got to figure this out. And so they're like, we can't call it childhood onset diabetes anymore. We know what we'll do. We'll fix this. We'll call it type 1 diabetes. And you're like, oh, you guys, you missed the point. The point is that the name can't be used anymore. So why are adults getting? So 80% reduction. Now, in autoimmune disease, there's hundreds of different names for autoimmune diseases based on what body part gets attacked. But truly, it's really one disease that can attack any body part. And that's why it's so easy to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've seen 8-year-olds with 4, women are 20s with 7. It's just one thing I've done because they're all the same. They just attack different body parts. So you've got to fix why you got the first. Otherwise, you get a second, third, fourth. So if you're preventing type 1 diabetes, you're probably preventing all autoimmune disease. Cancer is the flip side of the same coin as autoimmune disease. If you're preventing autoimmune, you're probably preventing cancer. But they also found in these children that grew up, they didn't get schizophrenia. We now know that if you're preventing one brain-like thing, you're probably preventing all brain-like things because the same things drive brain stuff in everybody, but it may show up in different people different ways. And so you look at this and you're like, that's so cool. And now we know the epigenetic thing you're talking about is every cell in our body has a receptor for vitamin D. So vitamin D will attach to that vitamin D receptor, tell the cells what to do. Every cell has them. It must be darn important for all the cells in our body. The vitamin D receptors, when that vitamin D hits it, it produces a protein called a vitamin D responsive element. It goes to other genes to impact them. So vitamin D responsive elements will actually turn off every gene that predisposes type 1 diabetes and every gene that predisposes to autism. And you're like, how many people with autism and type 1 diabetes could be spared this by getting the vitamin D receptors to do their work? By making sure vitamin D is in the right amount. We just don't make it from sun exposure. I got a flip-flop tan, like I referenced. It's so hard to make vitamin D from sun exposure nowadays. And that includes me. That's how I take it every day.
Absolutely. And I think to your point, especially in the type of lifestyles we have, our limited exposure to the sun for sure. And that's something you shared with me. Now, just I'm personally curious too, just because I've mentioned to you, I have a baby on the way. So how do you introduce vitamin D in the first year for the baby? Is it just through mom's diet or is there a supplement you can offer to the baby as well?
Usually I use a liquid supplement.
Okay.
Now, if you have the mother taking vitamin D during the pregnancy and then have the children after delivery, that is profound for a lot of reasons, including this really cool study that came out just about a year ago, a couple of years ago, maybe now. Time really flies. So they gave moms that had already had a child with autism. If you already have a child with autism, the chances of your next child having autism is huge. One in five, 20% chance. Okay. So they gave the moms 5,000 IU per day, every day during the pregnancy. Now, 5,000 may sound like a lot, but it's probably way less than you need to be to get to that optimal blood range. But it's something. And then for the first 3 years of life, they gave the children 1,000 IU per day. That's even more pixie dust dose than the 2,000. But they saw that rather than 20 out of 100 kids getting autism in this population, 5 out of 100. So rather than 1 in 5, it was 1 in 20. We saved 15 out of every 100 times this happened from getting autism. And not even optimally using the vitamin D, just using like tiny little doses. You can imagine the potential benefit if you actually did a blood test. Okay, 5,000 to start with. That sounds okay. Let's check your level in 8 weeks. Go up if we need to. Oh, your child, 1,000. Okay, we'll check them in 8 weeks because you can draw blood on a 8 week old, right?
Yeah.
And change the dose. And let's get them all perfect. And you go, boy, I can't imagine the benefit if they actually did it that way. We're talking during pregnancy. That's a great thing. We're talking during early in life, a great thing, including like with pregnancy. If a woman takes a probiotic during pregnancy, she's decreased the risk of every pregnancy related complication. If there's anything that you do not want to have during a pregnancy, you're going to decrease the risk simply by taking a probiotic every day. And these are the kind of things, though, the kind of these pregnancy related issues that are going to create physical stress and emotional stress, probably in the mom, start altering her HPA axis, alter the development of the HPA axis in developing fetus, set them in a bad compromised position the whole life, and let's fix it. But it's, how easy is that? A little vitamin D, a probiotic.
Right.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of that information isn't available. So I feel like my wife's done a good job of staying on top of those things. So good for her. But there is the generational impact too. And that's something you had shared and you briefly touched on it earlier of how far these things can carry forward into future generations. So does that mean that we're a victim of choices that were made before, or do we have some agency in making changes for future generations, depending on how you look at it?
Both. This is generational health issues where what's happened in the past 6 to 8 generations have altered epigenetics. So traumas in those generations, things like adverse childhood events, divorce, separation, substance abuse, incarceration, physical, verbal, sexual abuse, trauma, all these kind of things, alter epigenetics. Traumas as adult offer alter epigenetics. Medicines taken can alter epigenetics. Taking antibiotics, as saved a lot of people from dying, but alters the gut, which alters epigenetics, all these kind of things. If you don't optimally reset the epigenetics before conceiving a child, you're passing on compromised epigenetics. And so we're actually the product of the last 6 to 8 generations. Whether they alter their epigenetics back in a great place before they conceive the next generation, or maybe they weren't able to, then that's the thing. So this is where you're like, how can a child 8 months old get like juvenile rheumatoid arthritis? Especially Dr. Billstrom, when you say for somebody to get the first symptom of a chronic health issue, it takes 10, 20 years. The body's fighting the fight for a decade or two before you even had the very first symptom. Geez, my knee hurts. I'm a 40-year-old. Hasn't gone away. I just got diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis 2 years later or whatever, 3 years later. And you go, okay, 1 to 2 decades. An 8-month-old hasn't been on this planet long enough, right? This is this epigenetic stuff, including this microbiome stuff too. But if we can optimize epigenetics by age 19, we set the system in a really good place for the rest of our life. But also if we can optimize epigenetics before we conceive the next generation, we're actually passing cleaner genes onto the next 6 to 8 generations, which is awful powerful when you talk about helping the person themselves, the child, the adult, but also if you can do it during maybe an optimal time frame of their life, you got generations following you that are benefiting from the choices that you make. And rather than all these childhood diseases that we see now that are so darn common, it's, oh my gosh, children, if it's not autism, it's developmental delay. If it's not that, it's ADD, ADHD. If it's not that, it's depression, anxiety. If it's not that, it's bipolar, schizophrenia. If it's not that, it's migraines or seizures. If it's not that, it's peanut allergies and gluten intolerance and dairy intolerance and asthma and allergies and eczema. And it's, holy cow, it is so hard to be healthy as a child. But we can actually undo this kind of stuff. It's not just a given that the next generation's going to have all this stuff. We can actually shift it through this epigenetic stuff. Now, in my practice, I use supplements that work through epigenetics. But what I'm using are things that the body should be making, but isn't making like it should. Thus, the epigenetic reset that the body is designed to do isn't happening. but you can reset the system. The body starts making these great things again. And this is part of this epigenetic stuff, is actually the body starts doing it itself. Mm. And then we put in a position to maintain this great ability to keep the genes flipped just the right way, ideally their whole life.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I just want to briefly touch on the microbiome, because that's something I've covered on the show. But I think now we're understanding the role of the microbiome better and how to take care of it. But from your perspective, how crucial is the microbiome in all of this? We've touched on it many times, but I think it's, from my perspective, it's one of the most important things, but I want to get your thoughts.
Yep, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Now, the intestinal microbiome is the one that most people hear about, mm-hmm. and easily disrupted, stress, HPA access stuff, mm-hmm. antibiotics, Motrins and Advils, a lot of other medicines will disrupt mm-hmm. the intestinal microbiome. And then that throws off everything because the gut is involved in everything. So they talk about the intestinal microbiome brain axis, because it's so involved in brain stuff. The intestinal microbiome eye axis, the intestinal microbiome breast axis, its involvement in whether you get breast cancer or not. The intestinal microbiome pancreatic beta islet cell axis, the cells that make insulin, and it gets whacked and you get type 1 diabetes because of this gut stuff. But every body part has its own unique microbiome. Mm. So the palm of the dominant hand is different than the palm of the non-dominant hand. Back of the hand, different palm, elbow crease, different than axilla, all different ones. When the intestinal microbiome, it tends to control other microbiomes off, or vice versa a little bit. So a big one that we knew about, and it was a huge deal like four decades ago, but people totally missed it and forgot it, is the oral microbiome, how important that is. And so how do you know your oral microbiome is off? If you're getting cavities, it's off. You got gum stuff going on, easily bleeding gums, receding gums. You got an oral microbiome disruption. Now, four decades ago, they said, oh, people with gingivitis, this oral microbiome disruption, those bad bugs can get from the mouth past the tight junction that connects the gums with the teeth into the bloodstream, goes all over the place, including the blood vessels, creating inflammation, hardening the arteries. It increases risk of heart attack and stroke. And then that whole oral microbiome got forgot for a whole bunch of years. And it turns out you got a bunch of bad bugs in the mouth. You're going to be swallowing them. They're going to contribute to the disrupted oral microbiome. And that lecture in Paris I talked about, the oral microbiome is the dominant microbiome that determines the health of the placenta microbiome during pregnancy, the placenta connecting the mom with the developing fetus. And you need this incredible crosstalk back and forth. Mm-hmm. to optimal fetal development. If you got a disrupted oral microbiome, that's going to disrupt that development, set the person in a compromised position, all these kind of things. And the microbiome, like the intestinal microbiome, has got to make a lot of important things that our body mm-hmm. needs to function. Mm. And we talk about this epidemic of like brain stuff, depression, anxiety. Oh my gosh, it's so common, whether it's children or adults. And so you hear a lot about a hormone called serotonin. And they say it's to feel good neurotransmitter. It's really important in mood and calmness, but it's also important in the immune system, sleep hygiene. It's important in not letting constipation happen, all these important things. 95% of serotonin is made in the gut by the good bacteria. And only 5% is made in the brain in a place called the Raphe nucleus. And so it's, holy cow, that important neurotransmitter is made by our good bacteria and 95% of it in the gut. I go, I know, that gut is so cool what it does for this stuff, right? And you disrupt the intestinal microbiome. Here's all this brain stuff. GABA production creates calm. That can get disrupted. Melatonin production comes from the gut. Melatonin, you go, that's just a sleep-wake cycle regulator. Probably not all that big a deal, even though we got a population of bad sleepers. But I'm like, hang on a second. Melatonin as a hormone is a great example of how hormones are so much more important than we give them credit for. They get rid of inflammation. And by keeping away inflammation, they keep away disease. So people with higher melatonin levels, a lot of it made in the gut, less Alzheimer's, less heart attack, less stroke, less cancer, less osteoporosis. It's, holy cow, those hormones do a lot. And I go, yeah, those good bacteria. I'm making this hormone, melatonin. You hear a ton nowadays about dopamine.
Yes.
50% of all dopamine is made by the good bacteria in the gut too. And so if you got this disruptive intestinal microbiome, it's not making the things we need. 80% of the immune system surrounds the gut. And so it's going to create all this cancer and autoimmune crud. And so, boy, that gets disrupted. Or the fetal development before they're even born is not started in the right position.
Mm-hmm.
Or they get an antibiotic around the time they're born, or they get an antibiotic right after they're born, or they get thrown in the neonatal intensive care unit and they get all stressed out because bells and whistles are going off and lights are being thrown on in the middle of the night and they prick the little baby's heels to get blood draw. What's that little baby's cortisol doing? Stress always whacks the gut. Stress always has an adverse impact on the intestinal microbiome. You talked about studying before a test. Here you got this big test. Now, in med school, before we had this big test, we're all ready to go in the big exam room, right? And we're all like stressed out. Ideally, I'm trying to chill out. Somebody goes, oh my God, I got to go to the bathroom. They run to the bathroom because they got to poop their brains out. They're so nervous right before the test, something like that. Or it's, oh, I'm getting all this acid indigestion. I'm so stressed. And so, yeah, stress nails the gut. It does that in a neonatal intensive care unit as well. Thing. And so this is another part of what I'm doing. I'm educating people what these things happen when these things happen at young ages, jaundice around the time you're born, antibiotics, preterm birth. Oh my gosh, is that stuff whacked the system going to the NICU? Mm-hmm. Hey, we know what that just did to your child. Let's get them on daily vitamin D. Probably want to get them on a baby probiotic. We probably need to do this because we don't want that to set their system in the place we know it does, because that's not going to be good for their whole life. But we can tweak it early on and really do our due diligence to make sure this stuff doesn't happen. And it's everything, right? Because it's so connected. No silos like you referenced.
Yes. Yeah. And I appreciate the depth of how you've explained it. And one of the things you and I had chatted about was prevention. And with prevention, food and how we eat and tying it to the gut microbiome, one of the things you didn't touch on, but I know we can talk about it now, is the type of food we consume nowadays, right? And the impact that's having on our microbiome. And on the flip side, you were talking about some of the important neurotransmitters or hormones. So even melatonin, I feel a lot of people will try to take supplements to make up for it, but then there's no regulation that the body is designed to do. So I feel like sometimes we deceive ourselves that, oh, if I take the supplement, then it'll fix the problem. But I don't think that's the case. But tying it all together in terms of the food we're consuming nowadays and processed food, you talked about the oral microbiome, which I think is an important distinction as well in terms of the bugs we're creating in our mouth by what we're eating. And putting all of that together when it comes to prevention, again, recognizing we all have a lot more agency than we think in the choices we can make.
Yeah. And so the person that coined this term, I thought was an absolute genius. Mm. The standard American diet, the SAD diet. It is so sad what most people eat, the standard American diet.
Mm.
And I think that just says it all. And to your point, I believe if you feed, you get what you feed. And if you're feeding good things into your gut, you're feeding the good bacteria, the good bugs, these bugs that are fighting the battles for you. And if you want to win your battles, you need as many warriors fighting your battles for you as you can. If you put in the standard American diet stuff, fast food, highly processed stuff, all this kind of stuff, you're feeding the bad bugs. And then they're overgrowing. And so you can actually, by what you eat, determine your good, bad mix. Boy, that sets the body in at least a position to take care of itself and to reverse things. Now, I say that kind of thing will open up the window of opportunity to fix everything. Now, by the time you might decide, I've been eating the standard American diet for a long time, I need to change things. Mm. That's a great place to start. But the system's gotten so messed up, you probably need some additional help.
Yeah.
I need a little extra help building those good guys up because I haven't had many of them for about 20 years. I need a little help doing this and that and a little help with this epigenetic stuff, but at least it opens up the window of opportunity. And some people can do that and go, oh my gosh, I feel great. I never felt this good. And it's fantastic. That's great. Other people are like, I'm not sure I'm getting the bang for this effort. Why am I even making the effort? Because I don't think it's really helping me much. I'm like, no, I can guarantee you it's helping you. Even though you don't feel any better, even if you're still getting new problems on top of the old, it's not a waste of time. You've set a foundation to build from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we want to do some testing to find out what hasn't shifted and what specifics we have to take care of. But I can guarantee you, we do a blood test that you can run in any hospital, Quest, LabCorp, you name it. I will be able to point out to you the tests that would be terrible, but aren't in you, but would never be good if you hadn't made those choices already. Exercise, deep breathing, meditation, repetitive prayer, getting rid of the standard American diet, all these things that people do. I will point out to you the benefit you've gotten from that. And what that really means with like disease risk reduction. Okay. I'll go, cool, look at that. You profoundly decreased risk of heart attack and stroke and cancer and osteoporosis and Alzheimer's and mood issues, all by doing, making that thing good on a blood test kind of a thing. But I'll also say, this is the stuff that still needs to be addressed to get you over that hump so that you can finally say, I am feeling tremendous. I haven't felt this good in maybe decades, maybe my whole life. And I can tell you that we have now done our due diligence to prevent future disease, such as vitamin D. I use vitamin D because it gets poo-pooed on its importance. The science is, if anybody goes to PubMed, which is where all the scientific articles are, right? And you put in vitamin D and then just stop there and hit enter. When I lectured, what, like 12 years ago, there was already like 11,000 articles about vitamin D. And now, a decade later, there's probably 50,000, 100,000, the thing. And you go, whoa, we know a lot about vitamin D. Most medical people don't know that data, okay? They may know what medicine to put you on if you have high blood pressure. They may know what medicine if you already got breast cancer. They may, but they don't know this stuff, including, I'll talk about vitamin D levels between, we used to say 70 and 90, and then it was at least 75. And then now it's truly, we probably need to be 90 to 100 on a blood test. Cardiovascular disease, we've known for decades, you need to be 95 or more. Parkinson's 100 or more. All this kind of stuff, super safe to get this level. And, but if a woman just gets her vitamin D above 60, still like 30 to 40 points lower than optimal, just getting above 60 for a woman, studies have shown 20 years ago that you've decreased your risk of ever getting breast cancer by 82% by doing that one thing. You're 82% of the way to never getting breast cancer. Now we still got 18% more to go. The thing, I kind of say there's tons of studies that say for every 30 points you bring up your vitamin D, you decrease your risk of ever getting any cancer by 25%. So if you get a woman to 60, oh good, we're 82% there. The guy gets up 30 more points. If it gets you up 30 more points, we decreased your risk of getting any cancer by 25%. So we probably got that breast cancer risk getting close to 100% reduction, the whole thing.
Right.
And that's just doing one thing, let alone there's that intestinal microbiome breast axis. This is what you do to the gut, which is actually, you got to, those vitamin D receptors in the gut become resistant to vitamin D. So vitamin D can't attach and do all that cool work we referenced, right? Like turning all these cool genes. That messes the gut up in a way that messes up everything. You fix it. I did a whole series of videos about this. That's exactly what you want to do to prevent breast cancer. And other stuff I talked about, that's exactly what you want to do to reverse autoimmune disease of the gut, the ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. That fixes major depressive disorder. That changes personality traits. People become more outgoing and more social. And so what you fix it with, I do a shout out to my med school, if you don't mind.
Of course.
University of Illinois. These are Chicago researchers, Chicago campus researchers. I was in Rockford. The foundational triad, daily vitamin D, daily probiotic. I already talked about those guys. And then butyrate, which maybe people haven't heard. So butyrate, I actually talked about already today. Made by the good bacteria. Butyrate producing good bacteria. Butyrate almost exclusively works through epigenetics. Made by the good bacteria, right, to optimize epigenetics. You do those three things of supplements together, it fixes the vitamin D receptor resistance in the gut, which fixes the gut in the way that fixes everything that I just mentioned. And it's, oh, that is so cool. That's not as hard as we thought, including I did a whole series of videos for Breast Cancer Awareness Month back in 2024 about the data that says, this is what you want to do to prevent breast cancer. Because if you don't, that intestinal microbiome breast microbiome axis is disrupted, driving breast cancer.
And that's powerful. For sure, in terms of just the choices we make. And we didn't touch on the gut-brain barrier as well, but that's something else we have to protect in terms of what's getting access to the brain and in terms of the things we're putting into our body as well. But you also touched on exercise. Are you able to expand on why exercise can help with all of those things, including we haven't spent a lot of time talking about inflammation as well. And inflammation is one of those things that we may feel it in the body, but it's affecting our mood and disrupting a lot of other things that we don't necessarily attribute to it.
Yeah. So this is where any body part that's not happy, there's too much inflammation. Now, there's a couple tests that doctors tend to run on a blood test, sed rate, and it's two tests. You got me going about all this other stuff. I don't worry about these tests because they're not really helpful. They go, oh, you don't have inflammation because these two tests are not up, the CRP and the sed rate. And I go, nah, if you've got a body part not happy, brain, you name it, whatever body part we're talking about, bone, osteoporosis, there's too much inflammation. Because the immune system, the innate immune system, is supposed to control inflammation. Now, the innate immune system will try to make inflammation also. And you say, why would my immune system try to make inflammation? I thought it was supposed to get rid of inflammation because inflammation drives chronic disease. I say, you'd think so. But there are times when the immune system has to make pro-inflammatory cytokines, things that create inflammation. Your immune system comes upon a cancer cell. One of our cells turn cancerous. It's our enemy. It's not us. It makes inflammation to kill that cancer cell. We get an infection like a cold virus. It's our enemy. The immune system makes inflammation to kill that cold virus. But things happen. Things get whacked in the system. The immune system thinks it's doing the right thing, but it's not quite, it's being told the wrong information. And so it actually starts making inflammation that will then start negatively impacting our own body parts. So here is brain inflammation. Every brain thing you can think of, doesn't matter what name you put on it, it's a brain thing, too much inflammation. Gut stuff, gut inflammation, muscle pain, muscle weakness, muscle inflammation, all that kind of stuff. And so this is where the immune system is tied into all this kind of stuff, including this excessive inflammation that drives chronic disease. So if you get the immune system better, because 80% of the immune system surrounds the gut, the first thing you should think about when you have any chronic health issue, including this inflammation that drives chronic disease, what the heck's going on with the gut, intestinal microbiome, stuff like that.
And then coming back to the exercise piece to then tie it together, the role of exercise when it comes to prevention, but also improving our health.
So I think exercise is a lot like avoiding the standard American diet, is it puts you in a good position to stay healthy and happy, because you get this flood of pleasure-causing chemicals like the endorphins, the metenkephalins, these morphine analogs. You feel good after you exercise. It floods the system. Neurotransmitters are produced that all help everything feel better. It creates calm. It helps the HPA axis and all this. But people can be exercising great, avoiding the standard American diet, eating real healthy. But it's so hard to be healthy nowadays. Functional medicine doctors say you can't see somebody dying on the inside by looking at the outside. If you can get somebody that looks darn healthy, eating healthy, exercising every day, dying of a massive heart attack in their 20s nowadays, or 30s, and women getting metastatic breast cancer in their 20s. Over 100,000 women in the United States alone every year, by the time they're diagnosed with mammography breast cancer, it's already metastatic. Over 100,000 metastatic by the time they get diagnosed. And so there's so much more than just exercising and eating healthy, including all these things that can happen through past generations, all the things we're young, that will disrupt the intestinal microbiome, start throwing off the immune system, inflammation control, all these kind of things. But when we say we got to start exercising and totally change how you eat, that sounds really complicated. Hard.
Yeah.
People go, that sounds really hard, but also very vague. So how do I exercise and what do I eat? And I go, it's not that hard. Okay, we can do some things like vitamin D we reference. Like, that's pretty darn easy to take a capsule of vitamin D every day. Or when you're pregnant, take a capsule of a probiotic every day. Now, can we talk about sunlight?
Of course.
Can we do that? Sunlight. Okay, so the eyes. We have rods and cones. They're what they call the image-forming retinal cells. Sunlight, light in general, hits our rods and cones. They send information up to part of the brain called the visual cortex. We can see images. Okay. But over the last 20, 30 years, scientists go, there's something going on with the eyes that we cannot explain by the rods and cones alone. Something weird is going on here. Then they found these things called non-image forming retinal cells. Light hits the non-image forming retinal cells. The nerve pathway, which all the tests I had in med school and residency, when they say, hey, what nerve goes from here to here? You go, look, this is easy. The first part of the word starts where it starts, and the last part of the word is where it ends up. So this is the retinal cells, back of the eye, non-immaturing retinal cells, hypothalamic tract, goes right to the hypothalamus. And all the listeners here go, oh, hypothalamus pituitary adrenal, that's that HPA axis we talked about. So light directly creates calm and helps to heal disrupted HPA axis or keep it healthy. But now there's all these little side roads that go off to part of the brain involved in emotions, the amygdala, part of the brain's involved in the mood, the perihabenula, part of the brain that's involved in the 24-hour circadian rhythm, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the master clock that oversees a 24-hour clock in every cell in our body, including the intestinal microbiome, is a 24-hour clock, and it gets thrown off when our clock is off. Part of the brain that goes to our eating practices and whether we get obese and all this other kind of stuff. So you're like, sunlight will impact all that positively. And I know, I say, yeah, I know. But also, because the intestinal microbiome is a 24-hour clock, if you get stimulation of the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the master clock, it helps the intestinal microbiome. Now, sunlight that hits our abdomen, a study that came out in March of 2025 said you don't even need to hold your shirt up. It actually goes through clothing, helps the intestinal microbiome. Wow. Building good guys, getting rid of bad guys. The cool thing, it's mainly infrared. The ultraviolet has a benefit. So this is near infrared, infrared, far infrared. So people hear a lot about infrared. So this was like the first 3 hours after sunrise when infrared is dominant from the sun, hits our abdomen. The good bacteria that are predominantly growing with the help of the sun are the butyrate producing good bacteria.
Wow.
These guys that we talk about that work through epigenetics, that's why they prevent and kill cancer cells five different ways. That's why they prevent osteoporosis. That's why they do all this kind of stuff they do.
Yes.
How cool is that? And during pregnancy, a third of the way through the pregnancy, there's a lot of baby parts still to put together. A whole 6 months of baby parts, plus the liver isn't even fully formed until 8 months after we're born. The brain's not even fully formed until 27 years after we're born. The immune system's not even fully formed until 8 years after we're born. A lot of baby parts to put together. But at 3 months gestation, the baby's eyes have already formed these non-immaturing retinal cells. They are starting to see light coming through the abdominal and uterine wall so they can develop this healthy HPA axis. Circadian rhythm, that's why they're awake when the mom wants to sleep or they're asleep when the mom's awake.
Yeah.
Mood, emotions, eating and metabolism stuff. Their fetal microbiome is shifting the right way before they've been born because they can see this. So this is why I tell women when they're pregnant, loud and proud, get that tummy out there.
Yeah.
Let the baby's eyes see the light. They did a study in mice that if they knocked out the development of these non-image-forming retinal cells, the image-forming retinal cells, the rods and cones, can't form. So the baby's eyes, non-image-forming retinal cells, has to see light to even make the rods and cones that allow us to see images.
Wow.
Yeah. It is such a central mechanism, but people can do this themselves. So get outside first 3 hours after sunrise. I used to say, you're in the northern climates. Can you give your tummy like 2 minutes? It all takes us 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was pretty cold. 2 minutes is a long time. But now so you go, it goes through a shirt too. Not quite as good, but awful darn good. And studies have also shown that the tabletop infrared models aren't quite as good as the sun, but they're awful darn good at doing all this kind of work we get. And I go, so I just told you how you can use the sun. All it takes is 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And probably has a much bigger positive hit to the system than all that exercise, changing how you eat. So when it comes to exercise and changing how you eat, I go, the body's too smart to require you to be perfect to get the sun fix. Perfect enough. Everybody's a little different how perfect, but perfect enough is fine. You don't have to be perfect. Particularly if you got this out, these other tools like we're sharing today. I don't have to be nearly as perfect as I thought with all this food or exercise. If I just do some of that's going to be give me a big impact, and this other stuff will take me the rest of the way.
Yeah. And that just emphasizes one of the things you had shared with me was not only getting education on how powerful our body is, but the body is so resilient that it knows how to fix itself. So
absolutely,
just emphasizing that based on everything you've shared. And
yeah, so true. People go, I got all these health issues, like, body, why can't you fix this? It's like, body, you're abandoning me. And the body's like, no, that's not how it works. I know how to fix this stuff. I'm trying to fix this stuff.
Mm.
Things have gotten in the way.
Right.
All you got to do is get this stuff out of the way, and I'm good to have my opportunity. And maybe I waited 50 years for this opportunity. You've had this thing for 50 years. I'm just waiting for my opportunity. Off it goes and starts fixing it.
Yeah.
It's really, really sweet how that happens.
Yeah. And the last question I have before you take off here, but you talked about prayer. What are your thoughts on the role of prayer in all of this?
Yeah. So repetitive prayer is in that class, like deep breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, meditation, yoga, tai chi, gong, all these kind of things that create calm in the body. Mm-hmm. Ideally, originally to help fix cortisol, help cortisol find calm. Back about 20 years ago now, there was two studies that already happened, the second one in India, and then Harvard got wind of this, that meditation is one works through epigenetics.
Mm.
So then they did what to their mind was this quintessential study to see if this truly happens with meditation. But it's the same thing that happens with repetitive prayer and all this, is they took this large number of people that done some kind of relaxation, maybe a lot of that list I just gave, every day for between 3 and 27 years. Another group that never done this stuff.
Mm.
They checked their epigenetics. And there was 2,000 genes that were turned off and turned on differently between the two groups.
Wow.
And I said, well, that's so cool. So now we're going to take these people that have never meditated and teach them how to meditate. And we're going to ask them to do 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 8 weeks. After they did that, they rechecked their epigenetics. And of the 2,000 genes that were flipped differently originally, 400 had flipped in the new meditators to match the old meditators.
Wow.
And they said, wow, what do they do? Oh, they code for inflammation. Whether we get this inflammation that drives chronic disease or whether we don't get the inflammation that drives chronic disease. And they said, that is profound. No wonder meditation works for everything. Repetitive prayer works for everything. Deep breathing works for everything. Now, that's really profound. But what I thought was an incredibly take-home message is they only had him do it for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
It's not like you had to do this for 5 years before you start getting the benefits. 8 weeks, your genes got flipping. But I think it also says a lot about human nature, is that humans are imperfect beings. Exercise, don't worry if it's not perfect. Change how you eat, don't worry if it's not perfect. Including these new meditators, Harvard said, give us 8 weeks.
Mm.
30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. On average, they did it 15 minutes a day, 3 days a week. So even Harvard can't get people to do it perfect for even 8 weeks, right?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
The body is so smart. You get these big impact players, a little bit goes a long way.
Yeah.
And it just speaks to the inherent ability of the body to fix itself, that these kind of things work through epigenetics. So does butyrate. So does vitamin D. This thing that I use a ton that the liver should make called TUDCA. All works through epigenetics. Your body's going to try to do it on its own. If it's not, well, we can now share the tools with people.
Yeah.
Get out your belly outside, make more butyrate, start fixing your epigenetics. Take some deep rest, repetitive prayer, fix your epigenetics. You know, it's a lot easier than people think.
For sure. No, that's a powerful message. I know we've got a time constraint. I could probably talk to you for another couple of hours. I have so many questions, which means might have to get you back on here. But for listeners that want to learn more about your work, you've talked about your YouTube channel, other ways of finding you. What are some ways they can find you online?
Sure. The best way is to go to my website, drdavidbilstrom.com. And we have courses for people that are non-medical people. We have courses for people that are medical people. We have tons of blog posts about this stuff, including one about early morning sunlight. There's another one about artificial light at night, notes from Paris, about this Paris lecture. There's blogs about this TUDCA and all these other things we talked about, all the YouTube videos. Hey, check out this article. Okay. And I just really want to educate people, whether they're medical or non-medical people, about this stuff, prevention and reversing the things that they already have, but also how we can make the next 6 to 8 generations healthier by the things that we do nowadays.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you again, Dr. Bilstrom, for this conversation. I took so much out of it, and I'm sure the listeners will as well, but really appreciate your time and everything you've shared today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Dr. Bill Strome. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader. The link to the newsletter can be found in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.